Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. And I have to say, I have a particularly artistic and creative game to talk about with you today. I'm going to talk about a few things. I'm going to talk about Forza Motorsport, which has just come out. I'm actually recording this one way back in time a couple of weeks ago, as I'm currently out on holiday in Tokyo, Japan. So I wanted to have one in the can for you. And Forza Motorsport just came out. So I played an hour of that tonight, and I've got some first impressions of that game for you. I was quite a big fan of Forza Horizon 5, and this will be the first time that I've tried a Forza Motorsport game. So it's an interesting thing to try out. I'm also going to talk a little bit about an indie game called Chants of Sennar, which has something to do with translation, and I'm not sure what actually. It's a pretty obscure game, but the featured game of this episode is going to be a very strange one called No, Play With Your Food. That is No, spelled N-O-U-R. It's an absolutely crazy game. So three games to talk about this week, and let's just get straight into it. So I'm going to start with Forza Motorsport. As I said, I played Horizon and I really enjoyed it. This series has a reputation as the more grown-up, pure racing game older brother of the more playful, riotous open world Horizon series, and it is a much more straight up and pure racing game. It's a track based racing game, and it's quite serious. It takes itself quite seriously, so as you might expect, this includes a lot of video montages of very shiny cars going around corners in slow motion, realistic graphics, obeying the racing line, although perhaps not quite as much as you were supposed to, as I found out, and some inspirational speeches about racing, tweaking your car's stats, practice laps, qualifying, and then the race itself. It's a pretty cool looking game. It's in first person, so you're sitting in the driver's seat looking through the windshield, and it has a pretty nice look. Like, the inside of the windshield will catch your driver's clothing, which you get to pick as the sunlight hits from a certain angle. So it's quite realistic. It's aiming for full realism, I think. And it throws you quickly into the action. So after a brief opening sequence, you find yourself sitting in the driver's seat of a speeding car, and it's straight into it. There is a racing line to follow. It's one of those racing lines that's blue when you are all good, and then the blue gets lighter and lighter. It turns to yellow if you're in danger because you're coming up to a turn. Then orange, and then red if you're going way too fast to make a turn and it looks like you're going to spin off the road. So you can obey the racing line, but I guess part of the fun of these games is knowing that the racing line is more of a recommendation than a directive. So you're trying to brake a little later than you should, accelerate a little sooner than you should, and really squeeze every second out of each segment of track. I started playing this one on full assist mode, I think mostly because of the reputation it has as a serious racing game. I'm not experienced in that kind of game, so I thought I'm going to start on full assist just to get a feel for it. But I did notice in the first couple of tracks that I did that the assist was making me behave in a way. It was braking more sensibly than I was intending to brake. It was cornering a little better than I was probably actually doing it, and so forth. And so I felt a little disconnected from the car. So after winning a couple of races handily, I cranked down the assist mode on all of the different monitors, all the different criteria that you can, and cranked up the drivatar difficulty of the AI opponents. And the game just sprang to life immediately. As I was in the next practice lap, I felt much more connected to the car. It felt more responsive. The screeching of the tires seemed to match what I was doing more closely. I had more control. I felt the momentum more of the car and the weight of the car during cornering, and suddenly it kind of clicked for me after about half an hour of play, and for the next half hour I was absolutely loving it. I was really in the zone, actually. So I think that Forza Motorsport is a game that will get better the better that you get at it, and it invites you to get good at it, to get that full motorsport racing feeling. A lot has been made about the visuals of this game. I watched the Digital Foundry video, which was a sort of quite tedious but also quite interesting breakdown of ray tracing, real-time reflections, and all that kind of stuff. But I'm no technophile, I tried a few different visual modes, and honestly, I couldn't really see the difference. It looks good, but it looks good in quite an unexpressive way, if that makes sense. It's going for full realism, but what you end up with is these expanses of very lightly textured grey concrete, a very bleached out and muted colour palette, and the foliage assets look very much like video game trees and not like real trees, if you know what I mean. And I wonder if when you strive for this kind of realistic graphics, it comes at the cost of a distinctive look. Nothing really seemed to pop visually. It doesn't really have a visual wow factor, I would say, which is kind of what I was expecting from a new Forza game. So I think it's less visually striking than Forza Motorsport 5, or Forza Horizon 5, rather. But that game is set in Mexico, so it has lots of topography to play with, lots of biomes. You know, you're racing down the side of a volcano, you're bouncing over sand dunes. There's a lot more room to make it feel and look good, and the colours really pop in that game. It's more saturated. So this is a more bleached out, serious game, but I guess we knew that. And I will say that that glimpse I got of its exciting qualities as a pure racing game sparked my curiosity. I'm quite curious to see if I can actually get good at that game, if I can turn the assist off completely one day and actually have a respectable performance on a track. So I have a feeling I'll be playing some more of that one. It's a very sensible, grown-up racing game. That's Forza Motorsport. I also played a little bit of Chance of Sinar in the last few days. This is an isometric puzzle game with a very clean art style. It's coloured in blocks, a little bit like Sable. It has that sort of stylized colour palette to it. And in this game, you play a monk who is working their way through a monastery. They seem to not speak the language of the country they are in or the place they are in. And so you will occasionally find signs in Chants of Sinar that seem to relate to the things that they are next to. So you might find a piece of paper pinned up next to a closed door, a piece of paper pinned up next to a switch. You can read them, you can ascertain or intuit that one means closed, the other means open, and that will come in useful as you are trying to solve puzzles later down the line where these symbols are displayed. You can enter symbols that you think you know the meaning of into a logbook, and then when you confirm them, they become part of your formal lexicon. So you're doing this kind of speculative translation based a little bit on placement of signs, based a little bit on pictograms, like the character itself might relate to what the word's meaning is. And I played about an hour of this one, and I have to say I didn't instantly gel with it. It does compare to other games that contain elements of translation. I think the star of the show in this genre is Inkle's Heaven's Vault, a game that I absolutely loved, that is based around translating small blocks of text, piecing them together, forming a lexicon, intuiting what pictograms might mean or hieroglyphs might mean in a way that felt very intuitive, very logical and natural. And although it is a very soft-edged act of translation, it felt good as a video game version. I would say that here in Chance of Sinar, I found it a little more spiky. It didn't quite come as easily. Some things, I wasn't making the right leaps of logic to really nail those words as fast as I felt like the game wanted me to. For example, you meet a guard who gestures to you, gestures at things, and then says pictograms, but I found it quite hard to piece the bits together to make sense of it. So I used a bit of trial and error to get through the first few rooms, and then I kind of tailed off, actually. It reminded me more of the things that I didn't like about games like Tunic or Fez, where there are codes everywhere that seem a little obscure, a little more obscure and demanding a little more effort than I felt like putting in. I would highly recommend Heaven's Vault, by the way, as we are talking about translation games. It's super underrated. I played that one on Switch and loved it. There is an episode about Heaven's Vault in the backlog. But as for Chance of Sinar, it's got a cool atmosphere and a good visual style. It is kind of intriguing, but the gameplay didn't speak to me, so I don't think I'll be continuing with that one. And finally, before we get to the main review of the show, I wanted to give a brief mention to a game called Mythforce. You may have seen this one. It's very heavily stylized in the style of old cartoons, like the original He-Man, the original Thundercats, Visionaries, all of the stuff that I grew up with. It's definitely playing on a strong nostalgia angle. And I saw a trailer for this one and I thought, wow, I haven't seen a game in that visual style before. I think I will give that a try. But I quickly found out that there is a bit of a disconnect between what the trailers were showing, which was this kind of high adventure combat with these cool cartoon characters running around. I felt like I had been catfished with this game, honestly. I came in expecting something resembling the source material. It turns out that this is a multiplayer game by default. So after a very brief, very confusing tutorial, with a screen covered in arrows pointing out every aspect of the UI, it looked like a kind of a conspiracy theory diagram or something with arrows and links and threads between things. I was spat into a multiplayer session with a bunch of people who had clearly been playing together for a while. There are four different heroes you can choose from. They all have different abilities. I picked a cool-looking one. It turned out that they are a melee tank slugger. And I was quickly just dismembered by mobs of skeletons as my teammates frantically run around me trying to revive me. I've never felt like I was in a wronger game for me than the 10 minutes I spent extremely confused and letting the side down in Mythforce. It was pretty funny, though. I mean, I was into the look of this game, but, you know, I'm not a big multiplayer fan, and this seems like a game where the people in the different hero roles have to really know their role. Like one is a ranged bow guy, one is a caster, one is a healer. I was a tank, and I was just getting absolutely decimated. So very sorry to my three teammates who saw me pathetically fail at Mythforce. But it's really not what I was expecting. It was kind of a funny experience. I didn't like it at all. I felt like it controlled weirdly and was just instantly overwhelming to me. Maybe fans of online co-op would feel differently. It certainly has a cool visual style. But that was a very confusing game to me, so I won't be playing any more Mythforce. And finally, just before we get into the review, I would like to say a big thank you to all the patrons of this show. This is a patron-supported show. If you enjoy it, you're welcome to come and join the Patreon at patreon.com/gamingin the wild. I will put a link to that in the description. And if anyone has signed up recently, I always give a thank you to new patrons on the show. I am not ignoring you. This is just recorded 2 weeks ago from when you're hearing it. So I will catch up on the thank yous when I get back. Any new patrons will get access to 10 bonus episodes and a soon forthcoming new one about my trip to Japan, Akihabara, the games I played in the arcades, the Nintendo store, all of that stuff. So if you are interested in hearing about that, that's going to be a patron-only episode going live in the next few weeks. And a big thank you to all my existing patrons. That's patreon.com/gamingin the wild if you would like to join in. And with that said, let's move on to the very strange and interesting game of the episode, No Play With Your Food. I should say right off the bat, actually, I always use music from the games that I'm reviewing. I could not find the soundtrack for this game anywhere online. It's not available to buy, it's not on YouTube, it's only on Spotify and only three tracks of it. So I've ended up using something roughly similar but a lot more mellow. It is a generative soundtrack, so that might be the reason that they haven't published it. It's a soundtrack that responds to the on-screen action, and so perhaps there are not definitive versions of it. The music that you're listening to is from a different game. It's from Oxenfree 2. It's one of my soundtracks of the year. I just put it in here for the vibes, really. But No Play With Your Food is developed by Terrible Jellyfish, aka a new studio led up by game developer TJ Hughes. It is published by Panic. The music is by Wind Mirage and some collaborators. It's pretty cool, actually. It's very fresh, contemporary electronica. And this game got a lot of early publicity, and it continues, actually. There was a developer interview on the PlayStation blog. It was in a PlayStation Direct, so I guess TJ and the publisher have done a good job with that. Although, on Metacritic, it doesn't have enough reviews to have a meta score, but the handful that are there are mostly fives and sixes, so a bit of a middling response to this one. I think, perhaps understandably, as it is quite an abstract game. Push Square said about this game, "It's an interactive work of art that lets you create your own playful, vibrant, and artistic images with an inviting soundtrack, but the gameplay loop was not enticing enough." A site called Multiplayer, based out of Italy, rated it only a 5 and said that it's a superficial culinary adventure with interaction often limited to simply raining ingredients onto deliciously decorated tables. Both praised the style of the game in their reviews, but all of the reviewers seemed to think that there wasn't enough meat on the bones of the game, no pun intended. I think I'm a little higher on this one than those reviews. I had a really good time with it. It reminded me of some Katamari, Watam-style Japanese craziness. It's very playful, and although it is very confusing, I did manage to extract a lot of enjoyment from it. So it's all good in my book. But the developers describe it by saying that it's an experimental food art game designed to make you hungry. Free from the constraints of scores, time limits, and realism, Noor lets you play with your food with no mess to clean up. And I have to say of this one, in summary, it's a wild, weird, bizarrely unstructured, physics-driven rhythm game in which you spawn food items into a scene, hit buttons in time to music, and just see if anything happens. As your pile of food turns into a ball of food-flinging chaos, sometimes it seems like there's a game in here trying to get out. Not much is clear, except that it's fun. And this is a really fun and strange game. It's not like anything that I've played before, that is for sure. It is the strangest game that I've played for quite a while. I had a similar sense of confounded enjoyment as I had playing Watam, from the creators of the Katamari series. An extremely strange game in which your character changes. You do just obscure actions to make unpredictable things happen. Watam blew my mind. But I had a similar sense of enjoyment playing Noor. But what is Noor? Okay, so Noor starts off with a voiceover, a kind of a philosophical musing in a cutesy voice that asks you, what colours make you hungry? And they kind of ramble for a bit in a kind of synesthetic poem about memories and colour gradients and tastes and grandma's cooking. And while this is happening, there's a very slick visual playing out, kind of a video collage of cereal falling into a bowl, sloshing milk going down over the cereal, but then freezing as it pours up out of the side of the bowl and into the air. And then the camera will kind of spin with this motion-frozen food happening. The style of it reminded me of like an Apple commercial or something. There are like blocks of blocked-out colour on the background, crisp minimalism and a spinning camera, lots of slow motion. And it sets a tone of playfulness, confusion, contemplation, and visual spectacle. And I would say that all of those things permeate and characterize what this game actually is. But as far as what the gameplay is like, you start off with a level menu. This is a large round dining table that you're looking down on. There are 20 plates around the edge of the table. One of them is in front of you. That is the one that you're selecting. Each menu is a plate. It's covered by a cloche. When you select the level, the cloche will lift to reveal the plate, and you're transported to the table scene. You go into the plate, and you're suddenly in an abstract space. Each space contains some kind of surface. Sometimes it's a set table. Sometimes it's part of a kitchen. Sometimes it's like a bento box. Sometimes it's an array of toasters. And what you do in these levels is you have the face buttons, and if you press them, you'll start to spawn food. Food items will start to fall into the scene from above. So what I did at first with this one was, like, say if it's a breakfast table, you hit one button and you drop a pancake. You hit another button and you drop a rasher of bacon. You hit another button and you drop down berries. And it's all very polite. Maybe it's not quite hitting the plate. Maybe they're falling on the table a little bit. And there is some minimalist music that is playing while you do this. It seems to be responding to you. Each piece of food has a sound that is related to it. It might be a pluck of a string, a hit of a drum. And so you start to realize that as you are dropping food, you're also interacting with the music, and the music seems to be responding to you. But this comes a little slowly, this realization. At first, it's just deeply confusing because you start dropping food items, and when there's enough for a meal, the game just keeps running. So all you can do really is start to drop more food and hit more buttons. So I started out trying to be quite neat and reasonable, but soon enough I was hammering all the buttons just to see what would happen. creating a surreal rain of food items, just covering the plate, spilling across the table, scattering around. I discovered that there is a button that will create a center of gravity that will lift up and gather all of the food into a floating ball. And when you let go, it will pop out and rain down again. So you really are playing with food here. The button prompts are tutorialized, but I would say it's a bit quick, it's a bit complex, and a bit clunky. There are lots of controls. It feels like every button on the controller does something, but keeping track of what exactly does what is a bit much given the visual spectacle that you are also witnessing. So I quickly stopped trying to have any kind of real control over what was happening on the screen. There was an element of surrender to this, and I started to play. And when I say play here, I'm not talking about the usual video game sense of using inputs, learning systems, carrying out different actions, which I expect to have predictable effects, considering strategies. All of that stuff just went straight out of the window playing this one. And I realized I was just literally playing. I was playing in the sense of a child in a ball pool, just flinging stuff around, raining down food just for the enjoyment of seeing it happen. And I realized after a while that my initial frown of confusion had kind of given way to a broad smile. And as the music was starting to respond to me and the cacophony was building, the colors on the screen were starting to pop harder and harder, that I was just smiling from ear to ear. And the game does tell you that you can zoom in and out, you can change the camera, so you can kind of scroll around and look at the chaos that is unfolding. If you keep pulling back on the camera will zoom out so far that it exits the plate and goes back to the level selector, and then the next level instantly unlocks. So if you are done with the level, you can just go on to the next one after, you know, just 2 seconds in a level if you're not feeling it. All of the levels are different. All of the levels have slightly different stuff going on, but all based around that mechanic of dropping food, manipulating food. So I came out of the first level, went into the second one. I think I was playing with some cereal. There's a level with toasters where I think there were like 16 toasters or 20 toasters in a grid. A different button prompts will push down the button on each toaster. If you hold it down, the toasters will overheat and start to pop. And suddenly there is toast just shooting everywhere. Sometimes it's almost raw. Sometimes it's golden and perfect. Sometimes it's burnt to a crisp. There was one where you're dropping donuts into a meat mincer, and then you turn the handle with the left stick, and you produce all of this like donut spaghetti. You can drop meat in there, you can drop milk in there. It's just an absolute mess. But something that became clear as I was skipping through these various levels was that there is a rhythm mechanic here too. There is a little, quite subtle prompt at the top left hand of the screen that is pulsing in time with the music. And if you start to hit buttons in time with the music, a small meter will start to fill up. I didn't notice it at first, but I noticed it after a while. And when that meter fills, the track starts to evolve. And with more playing around, I realized that if you keep playing in rhythm, in a fairly free-form way, different things start to happen on screen. You will start to get different visual effects. You will start to get colors that pulse in time. It starts to get a little bit psychedelic. If you just hammer the buttons crazily, you'll get a very, very, very hyper version of the track with bright pulsing colors on the screen that almost melt the whole scene. So the music speeds up in tempo and starts to flex and warp weirdly, as if you are putting your finger down on a record that is spinning to slow it down or spinning it to speed it up. So it feels like you're manipulating the music, manipulating the visuals in a way that is just on a very primal level, pretty satisfying to do. It's just cause and effect. You're doing stuff and cool stuff is happening. But eventually, the weirdest thing of all is if you keep playing in rhythm, a jellyfish will appear, a cartoon transparent jellyfish with a frowning face, and he'll start swimming around the screen and trying to steal your food. I didn't know what to make of this, honestly. I still don't know what the jellyfish is for after playing all 20 levels over the course of an hour. It reminded me a little bit of the bosses from the game Nights into Dreams. It has these really nonsensical boss fights where you're fighting against strange creatures just hitting buttons to try and make stuff happen. I couldn't make any sense of Nights into Dreams, but I enjoyed it in a similar way. It was a visual spectacle. But in the end, if you play for long enough with the jellyfish on screen, it seems to just disappear. You get a cutscene, and then something happens. I couldn't quite tell what, and then it vanished. It's hard to say if that meant the jellyfish had gotten bored and left, or had successfully stolen my food, or if by playing in rhythm I had banished it. I really couldn't tell you. It's hard to say what anything means in this game, really. But making the jellyfish appear by playing in rhythm and then playing on until it vanished became my own sort of self-imposed structure for how long I felt like I should play each level, even though I didn't quite know what it meant. I thought, well, at least I will try and do that and see if anything happens by the end of the game. So as I continued playing, some more obscure, esoteric kind of gameplay mechanics started to reveal themselves. When you hit different buttons, you will get symbols that pop up on the rhythm monitor of the screen at the top left. Sometimes it's a cross, sometimes it is a musical note, sometimes that note has a tail, sometimes it has a straight back, and it doesn't seem to correspond with the buttons you are pressing, so I'm not quite sure how it compares to a traditional rhythm game when you are hitting the buttons that you're told to hit. In this game, you are hitting any old button, and different symbols appear in a pattern that I could not figure out. You know, I sat for 5 minutes just trying out different sequences, hitting the X button on the offbeat, or going around the notes in a clockwise or anti-clockwise circle, or trying to trigger food items and sounds in different orders to the rhythm. Some things did seem to be happening on screen. I mean, I popped some trophies that said that I was triggering combos, but there was never a combo that I could intentionally repeat. So it was almost like a subversion of a rhythm game, which is all about hitting keys in sequence and in rhythm to pass. In this game, you seem to be hitting any old shit, and combos just happen and aren't replicable. Very, very strange, very discombobulating for a gamer brain, but in a way that I quite liked. And after you surrender to the craziness of it and just decide to enjoy the colors, enjoy the spectacle of this rain of food, of these balls of gravity-defying food spinning around the screen against vivid colored backgrounds and pulsing lights and experimental electronic music that I really liked, actually. It's pretty cool, crisp stuff. It's really fun, and I don't know what to say about it other than that. Like, I can't go any deeper into this game and tell you more about it or analyze it anymore because it seems to resist analysis in that way. I did wonder if there is more of a game in here and that it's just intentionally very difficult to decipher what is going on, or if it is just intended as a toy-like experience with some gamey elements, or ostensibly gamey elements. But it's hard to know what it is, it really is. And after all the 20 levels, there is a little cutscene at the end that was kind of fun, like the end of the meal. And then there's a characteristically nonsensical and difficult to decipher finale. And that was the end of the game. And with that, I think I'm going to talk about the good points and the bad points as much as I can. I would say in the good column, the visuals are very fun in this game. There's one where you're making a cocktail in particular, where there is bubbly liquid that you pour into a glass. Then you drop orange slices, lime slices, sprigs of herbs, different coloured spirits that make the drink into a bright cocktail. And that one went absolutely nuts. I really enjoyed the music in that one. And it was almost photorealistic. So it was very fun to look at, very fun to manipulate this sleek advertisement-style visual display and to throw all of that food at it. The food assets themselves, I would say mixed results on how they look. They look kind of like assets you might see in like a Blender tutorial or something, like a donut with sprinkles, blocks of meat with a texture slapped on the side of the block and it wobbles slightly. It's never like hi-fi stuff, but it's good enough. And it does definitely have a style to it. I would also praise the music. It's sharp, contemporary, it's choppy, it's quite experimental, and I love that it reacts to what you do. And playing something like this that so intentionally and absolutely evades understanding was kind of refreshing in a way. There's something a little bit liberating about just giving up on trying to understand anything and just taking it for what it is and going along for the ride. So it was a short, silly experience, but I really enjoyed it for what it was. And I think that that's a tick in the plus column. As for the bad stuff, there is a flip side to that coin. I mean, there do seem to be systems at play here. I couldn't tell if they were trolling me by looking like systems that are intentionally there but don't actually have any sense in them to decipher, just to draw your attention and hold it without giving anything in return. And I played through this game once. I don't think I will play it again. But I would say that if there was a little more game in here, then it could be something that I'd want to mess with more. Like if there were more tangible signs that what I was doing was building a body of knowledge about how to play the game, or at least offering some breadcrumb trail further into the game and its mechanics, I might have found it more intriguing as a game rather than just as an abstract visual toy, if you like. I do wonder if there is some kind of level of compromise that could have been reached here between the abstraction and chaos and freedom of it all and the other side of actually having a clue what you're doing or being able to decipher what your actions mean in the game. It's a creative choice. I think to have such an abstract, inscrutable, chaotic on-screen mess, but to feel like there is perhaps a tangible game in there somewhere was pretty interesting. But it's definitely abstract. It's hard to decipher. And I can see some people finding that a stumbling block for sure. So just to round this review out, I have absolutely no idea what this game is. It's an interactive art piece. It feels like an itch project that somehow made it to a full console release. Not quite sure how. It feels like a digital toy. I can't tell if there is a hidden structure inside this game. And maybe for people that have the patience and tenacity to methodically experiment long enough to crack the code of this game can explain what is actually in there. Maybe it's like the Rain World of food-flinging art project games waiting to be figured out. Or maybe it's just a silly good time. I decided to treat it as the latter. That is no play with your food. So a short episode this week, comparatively. I hope you enjoyed it. It was certainly fun to play Motorsport. I wasn't quite sure what to expect of it. And the experience that I got wasn't the one that I had perhaps imagined. I thought I might just play it for a short while and then bounce, just to, you know, check out the look of it, see how it felt to play. But I was quite surprised by how drawn I felt to this racing mechanic and actually trying to learn the game. It's not something that I was expecting, so I'm quite interested to play more of Forza Motorsport, see if I can get good at this racing game. Let's see if that holds up. No play with your food. I don't know what to say about that one. I mean, you probably heard me trying to feel around the edges of it. I don't know how far that I got, but I hope you enjoyed the review. This is a bit of a holding pattern episode. I'm recording it 2 weeks before you're hearing it. I recorded this one on the same day as the last one. I've never recorded two podcasts in a day before. I'm getting a little hoarse, actually, so I think it's time to call it a day. But if you enjoyed this episode, please do come and find me on social media. I'm everywhere as at Gaming in the Wild. You can also email the show if you'd like to suggest a game or just be in touch. My email is johnisgaminginthewild@gmail.com. I'll be back next week with a new episode. So as always, please do take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.